Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Martin Bulmer, and I'm the editor of Ethnic and Racial Studies. And on behalf of both LSE and the publishers of our journal, Taylor and Francis Routledge, I'd like to welcome you to the Old Theatre of the London School of Economics for the 1999 Ethnic and Racial Studies LSE Public Lecture. We shall follow the usual form, with our lecture taking some 50 minutes, a short period afterwards for questions, and then concluding with a reception in the senior common room upstairs. Our speaker this evening, I'm very pleased to say, is Yasemin Soysil, a young sociologist from the University of Essex. Dr. Soysil took her first degree in sociology and politics at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul, her PhD in sociology at Stanford University in California. From 1991 to 1998, she was at Harvard University, latterly as John L. Loeb Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology. While there, she was also an associate of both the Center for European Studies and the Center for International Affairs, and co-chair of the Research Group on Citizenship and Social Policies. She's been a visiting fellow at the Max Planck Institute in Berlin, and on two occasions, 1995-6 and 1997-8, Jean Monnet Fellow at the European University Institute in Florence. She's now senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Essex. Her arrival in the UK last year is a great gain for British sociology, and it's a particular pleasure to welcome her here this evening as our lecturer. Yasemin Soysil's interests center around the concept of citizenship. At least since T.H. Marshall's first formulation 50 years ago, citizenship has been a key concept in both sociology and social policy, has recently aroused new interest, and with the arrival of the EU has assumed increasing salience in the politics and sociology of Europe. Dr. Soysil is the author of a seminal monograph, Limits of Citizenship, Migrants and Post-National Membership in Europe, published by the University of Chicago Press in 1994, and of more recent articles, for example, Citizenship and Claims Making, Organized Islam in European Public Spheres, which appeared in Theory and Society in 1997. I'm delighted to invite her to lecture to you this evening on citizenship and identity in post-war Europe. Dr. Soysil.
Well, it's a great honor to be here this afternoon. I'm really delighted to give the annual lecture of the Ethnic and Racial Studies. It's been always one of my favorite journals. It's really, truly a leader in its field. Should I mention that I'm also on the editorial board? My thanks to Professors Martin Bulmer and John Solomos and the members of the editorial committee for giving me the chance to address this forum this afternoon. And I'm really delighted to do so. Okay, if I can get this working. Yeah. The unfolding episodes of world politics in the 1990s have brought intensified attempts to redefine nation-state identities. This apparent revival of the nation and citizenship, really important concepts, is clearly linked to a series of world-level developments. So if we think of large-scale international migrations, the political reconfigurations in the formerly socialist countries, and also the emergence of regional and transnational political entities, as we most clearly observe in the case of the European Union. But all these developments are clearly associated with the reassertion of nationalist narratives in different parts of the world. So we see fierce struggles for ethnic or national closures in former Yugoslavia, in Turkey, in Rwanda, in India. We see aggressive vocalization of anti-immigrant groups in the United States, but also in Europe. We also see an increasing concern with national sovereignties and borders, as exemplified in the reactions of some European governments and also some European societies vis-a-vis the advance of the European Union. And in addition, the devolution of the welfare state in the United States, but also in Europe, has increased the stakes of citizenship, which further stirred up restrictionist sentiments and also attacks on the right of immigrants. Such developments have generated a lively public and scholarly debate on exclusionary national identities, exclusionary citizenships. However, although highly dramatic and explosive, these recent developments do not display the complete topography of citizenship in the post-war era. The exclusive focus on current nationalist tendencies and the persistence in assigning the nation-state a privileged position in much of our thinking render invisible the significant transformations that have taken place in the post-war era. We commonly overlook the broader changes that underlie the contemporary institution and practice of citizenship. So, alongside the growing emphasis on national identities in the 1990s, we are as well witnessing the emergence of new forms of membership and also new forms of participation, which transforms the national order of citizenship. So, in this talk, my goal is to address these new forms and the broader dynamics that occasion their emergence. And what I would like to do is to start my talk with a very brief summary of the developments that contextualize these changes that I will be elaborating later on. And also, after that, I would like to talk about two paradoxes that I see as crucial in understanding the contemporary formations of citizenship, also contemporary formations of exclusions and inclusions. The first paradox, which I will talk about, relates to the rights and identities, the two main components of citizenship, and the paradox is about their increasing decoupling, their increasing separation from each other. And the second paradox regards the ways that collective claims are made and mobilized. And in this case, the paradox refers to the increasing tendency toward particularistic and group-based claims, but the justification of these particularistic claims through universalistic discourses and strategies. So a tendency towards particularistic identities and claims, but the whole justification and legitimation of these claims using some the universalist discourses, which I will again elaborate later on. So these are the two major points that I will be making in my talk. And I should say that the main argument that I try to develop in my work in general is that contemporary citizenship is again decoupled from national collectives and national boundaries. I argue that in the post-war era, the practice of citizenship shows increasing localizing and transnationalizing trends, and that's independent of belonging in a national collectivity. So, regardless of their historical or cultural ties to the German nation, and even without a formal German nationality, which is the case for most Turkish immigrants living in Germany, Turkish immigrants in Berlin make claims on Berlin's authority structures, and they participate in Berlin's public institutions. When they make demands for the teaching of Islam in public schools, the Pakistani immigrants in Britain mobilize around a Muslim identity, but they appeal to a universalistic language of human rights to justify their claims. And they not only mobilize to affect the local school authorities, but also pressure the national government and take their case to the European Court of Human Rights. So I argue that these examples undermine the predominant models of citizenship, which normatively privilege the national boundaries and also national communities. And I think that if we want to have a meaningful understanding of contemporary formations of citizenship, we need to incorporate these seeming anomalies into our analytical toolkit. The background to the arguments I'm advancing in this presentation are a series of legal, institutional, and ideological changes in the post-war European state system. And as I argued before, these changes have complicated the national order of citizenship, and they introduce new dynamics for participation in the public sphere. I would like to briefly cite four of these developments and their implications for the notions of identity and rights. Okay. The first development, it should be clear to everyone, I believe, the transformations in the existing national and ethnic composition of European countries. And this is obviously as a consequence of massive migratory flows in the post-war era, not only from immediate European periphery, but also increasingly from so-called distant lands. The second development is the intensification of transnational discourse and legal instruments that codify human rights as a world-level principle. And I think this is quite important, because this liberation of individual rights has laid the ground upon which more expansive claims can be advanced and led to the introduction of new forms of rights for women, children, minorities, immigrants, and even for animals and for plants, as Brian Turner argued. And if you lived in California, as I did for a number of years, you would really grow a strong sensitivity, actually, for the rights of plants. When I was finishing my PhD at Stanford, early 1990s, there was a big legal case going on between two Stanford professors. These were two professors who shared a wall in their gardens, and the whole legal case was about this tree. And actually, the legal case was about the trimming of the branches of this tree. One of the professors claiming that the branches were stopping him from enjoying his rights to a healthy Californian lifestyle and also sunshine. And the other one claiming that if they did cut the branches of the tree, that would violate the integrity of the tree, and it would really probably even hurt the tree. And I always thought that this is really a Californian example, and California being so far out there, and they do weird things after all. But I was reading the newspaper 2 days ago, and apparently there was an initiative in New Zealand to extend human rights to apes. It didn't go through apes, and it didn't go through. They decided not to follow up this, but. So it's broader than California, although New Zealand is also another end of the world, so you might think. Okay. The third development I would like to talk about is the increasing legitimacy of the right to one's own culture and identity. And this right has been furthered by the massive decolonizations in the post-war period, as well as through the works of the international organizations such as the United Nations, UNESCO, and the Council of Europe. So collective identity has been redefined as a category of human rights. Consequently, identities have become important organizational and symbolic tools for creating new group solidarities and mobilizing resources, again, as in the case of women's movements, environmentalists, gays and lesbians, regional identities and interests, indigenous groups, and also immigrants. And the last development is, again, this is quite specific to European case, but the whole point of the emergence of the multi-level polity with the diffusion of sovereignty among local, national, and transnational political institutions. And the importance of this is that it enables new actors and it opens up new organizational strategies and also facilitates competition over resources and definitions. But all these developments, they have paradoxical implications for national citizenship. They have paradoxical implications as regards the ways that rights and identities are organized or defined and allocated, and also as regards the ways that collective claims are made and mobilized. Let me talk about the first paradox. Again, as I have already mentioned, the first paradox is about the decoupling of rights and identity, and this is, again, the two main components of citizenship. In the nation-state mode of political community, citizenship is contingent upon national collectivity, and the rights and duties of individuals derive from national belonging. In the post-war era, however, we have witnessed an increasing recasting of national citizenship rights as human or personhood rights. So rights that were once associated with belonging in a national community have become increasingly abstract and legitimated at the transnational level. The post-war reification of personhood, it expands the boundaries of political community by legitimating individuals' participation and claims beyond their membership status in a particular nation state. So with this breakdown of the link between national community and rights, we observe multiple forms of citizenship that are no longer anchored in national communities. And these forms are exemplified in the membership of, for example, the long-term non-citizen immigrants who hold various rights and privileges without a formal nationality status. There are currently around 15 million foreigners living in Western European countries, and 10 million of whom are non-nationals of European Union countries, and also non-nationals of the countries of their residence. These people do have many of the rights and privileges of citizenship without holding a formal nationality status. Obviously, the most obvious exemption of these rights is the right to vote in national elections and also in local elections in some countries, but Scandinavian countries and some other countries have given rights to vote even in local elections. We also find an example of this new forms of membership or belonging, again, in the increasing instances of dual citizenship in European countries and in the United States. Again, because this provides access to rights in two different political communities. Or we find this in the European Union citizenship, which is a multi-tiered citizenship. And also, another example is the subnational citizenships in culturally or administratively autonomous regions of Europe, as in the case of Basque Country, Catalonia, or Scotland. As the source and legitimacy of rights shift to the transnational level, paradoxically, identities remain particularistic and locally defined and organized. So the same normative and institutional frameworks which celebrate personhood or which celebrate human rights, they at the same time naturalize collective identities around national and ethno-religious particularisms. This, as I already stated, has a lot to do with the works of the international organizations such as the United Nations, UNESCO, and the Council of Europe, but also, obviously, to do a lot with the discipline of anthropology, through which the universal right to one's own culture has gained increasing legitimacy, and collective identity has been redefined as a category of human rights. So what we normally consider as unique characteristics of collectivities, this is culture, language, and standard ethnic traits, they have actually become variants of the universal core of humanness or selfhood. We cannot think of the universal self without the culture, language, and standard ethnic traits. And in that sense, this identity represents the unchosen, and it's naturalized through the language of kinship, homeland, nation, and territory. One cannot help but have identity. Once institutionalized as natural, the discourse about identities creates ever-increasing claims about national self-determination and particularistic group rights. Ethnic national identities are enacted and improvised for mobilizing claims in national and world polities. And they get actually much support, as we see in the cases of Kosovo or the case of Kurdistan. Thus, while rights acquire a more universalistic form, and they are divorced from national belonging, in that sense giving rise to a more inclusionary form of membership, at the same time, identities become expressively particularistic, and the exclusionary practices on the basis of identity prevail. And this, again, we observe in the increasingly restrictive immigration policies of European countries, and the mobilization of ethnic or linguistic minority groups or religious groups for cultural closure. So in that sense, more inclusionary forms of rights clash with more exclusionary practices of identity. That's the first paradox that I wanted to talk about. Let me talk about the second paradox now. The second paradox that I would like to draw your attention to is to do with collective claims making and participation in public spheres. In other words, this is the practice of citizenship by individuals and groups. With the post-war reconfigurations in the institution of citizenship, which I just tried to relate to, the old categories that attach individuals to national welfare systems and also national distributory mechanisms become blurred. This inevitably changes the nature and locus of struggles for social equality and rights. So new forms of mobilizing and advancing claims emerge beyond the frame of national citizenship. Again, if we recall, our classical notions of citizenship assume the existence of actors whose rights and identities are grounded in national collectives. And these collectives constitute the authentic sites for claims making and civic participation. My research reveals two trends that diverge from this predominant prescription of citizenship. Again, as I mentioned before, first, we see an increasing tendency to advance particularistic identities and particularistic demands, but these are demands which are at the same time located in and legitimated by universalistic discourses of human or personhood rights. Second, we see that the mobilization of claims take place independent of nationally defined collectives and at multiple levels, local, national, and transnational. In other words, the social and political stages for claims making proliferate. Now, I would like to elaborate these two trends by citing empirical evidence from Muslim immigrant communities and their participation in European public spheres. And I do not want to imply that we observe these emerging forms only in the case of Muslim immigrants. That's not my intention. I think these are much broader tendencies. But I focus on Muslim communities because they obviously they are the visible focus of contention in many European countries. And in their case, it's much easier to see these new forms. Okay. First, the nature of claims and the discourse. Islamic groups in Europe mobilize around claims for particularistic provisions and highlight their group identities. Their claims, however, are not simply supported by particularistic religious teachings or traditions. On the contrary, they appeal to the universalistic principles and dominant discourses of equality, emancipation, and individual rights. These are discourses that we use dominantly in our own societies, equality, emancipation, and individual rights. When making claims, they do not categorically oppose religious demands and universalistic principles. They interpret and construe their claims through universalistic principles. And I will give some examples. And the first example, again, you will remember this, in 1989, the issue of Islamic flour erupted into national crisis and debate in France. This was when three North African students were expelled from school for insisting on wearing their veils in class, for covering their head in class. But this whole affair revived concerns about the laicism principle that the state and religion should be separate of the French state, the definition of the freedom of religion in France, and also the integration of immigrant communities. And it was, as I said, was a big debate at the national level. But during the debates, the head of the Great Mosque of Paris, and he is one of the highest authorities for the Muslim community in France, he declared the rules preventing wearing scarves in school to be discriminatory on the grounds of individual rights. His emphasis was on personal rights. He didn't mention religious traditions or duties, and he said, and I quote, he said, "If a girl asks to have her hair covered, I believe it's her most basic right." So in this case, Muslim identity, while symbolically represented by the headscarf, nonetheless was claimed through the very categories and language of the host country, that is, through a discourse that accentuates individual rights. Here, I should mention that this very discourse parallels the discourses used in other cases, in similar cases, not necessarily involving Muslim or immigrant communities. Again, in the early 1990s, and this is again an example from California, unfortunately, since I was living there at the time, there was a Berkeley freshman, University of California, Berkeley, a freshman. He was called a naked guy. He insisted on going to classroom naked, without any clothes on. And his whole case was that clothes are imposition, Western imposition on human beings. There are many cultures where clothes are not a part of the culture, and it's his right to dress or undress as he likes. This created a big debate again because it was offensive to some groups on campus, especially feminist groups. They thought they didn't want to see this guy naked, and he was actually referred to the disciplinary committee at the end. He flanked at the end, but his whole point was that it was his right to dress or undress as he likes, as an individual. There was another case, and this is in New Hampshire this time. It was a high school student, age of 15, and he decided to declare his sexual preference by wearing skirt to classrooms. And he did this for a while, and then there was again another disciplinary case. I don't know why this was offensive to anyone, given that there's a whole nation whose male members proudly wear the skirt. But it was, again, somehow, probably because it's out of norms, that it wasn't liked, and it was referred to the disciplinary committee. At the end, he was he decided not to do this. But the whole point, again, used for all these three cases that I mentioned, that they used the same claim, that it's their individual right to dress as they like. So in another episode, and this was Germany this time, on the 12th of November 1995, this corresponded to the birthday of Fatima. Fatima is the daughter of Prophet Muhammad. The Shiite Ahl-i Bayt Mosque, and this is one of several mosques in Berlin, they invited all Muslim women to a celebration of the World's Women's Day. Again, this was in November, and I saw this flyer, the flyer announcing this celebration in one of my walks in Kreuzberg, and it really caught my eye because it was still November, not March the 8th, when the rest of the world celebrate Women's Day. So I decided to go to the meeting, and this meeting was a meeting of 200 or so Muslim women from different nationalities, also including the male clergy of the mosque himself and some other male members of the mosque as well. There were women from different nationalities, Turks, Arabs, and Germans. But the focal point of the speeches delivered in this meeting, they were really about women's emancipation, and this included demands to end discrimination against Muslim women in workplaces, for example, especially on the basis of wearing the Islamic headscarf. In Germany, it's not a problem when students wear their headscarf to school, but in public in public workplaces, there's been cases where women were fired because they decided to cover their hair. So this whole issue was brought up, and there were other issues, but the major point is that in this meeting, all the speakers, including the clergy, male clergy, and also the women who spoke at the meeting, they used the very terms of the contemporary gender discourse. They were really using this gender discourse that we do use in our own conversations about women. The keynote speaker, and this was again this young imam, he traced the issue of the rights of women to the Quran. He said he was making some references to the Beijing World Conference on women. This was right after the Beijing World Conference. And he claimed the assertion, women's rights are human rights, as an original teaching of Islam and its culture. He declared indignantly, and I am quoting, "In the Beijing conference, when someone said women's rights are human rights, thousands of women cheered and clapped. What were they cheering for? We already said that 1,400 years ago. That's our word." End of quote. I don't think Quran or any other holy book for that matter mention women's rights or human rights or any rights of that sort. But he was very keen in his speech on claiming women's rights as human rights. And again, the important point is that this whole meeting was an instance of linking Islamic moral realm to the very contemporary concerns and discourses about women. This linkage was very, very clear, and it was very clear to him as well, obviously, and he wanted to make that connection. So let me insert a caveat here. Obviously, Muslim groups in European countries, they do not speak in a uniform discursive framework, because these examples that I just gave, they do not necessarily exhaust the range of narratives employed by different Islamic groups. Again, for example, speaking for the Islamic veil, this was a Turkish imam in Nantua. He declared the practice as God's law. He said that this is what God ordered us to do, and he pressured the Turkish families to withdraw their daughters from school. And this led to a serious division among Turkish immigrants and also to his eventual deportation from France. So it's possible, obviously, to find Islamic positions which base their claims on religiously codified family laws, which obviously, again, conflict with the principle of gender equality. I'm not trying to make a case that all the Islamic positions and claims will be in harmony with the existing principles of Western societies. So in that sense, these claims would point to alternative claims, again, and or alternative leadership among Muslim communities. But I focus on the universalistic discourses and claims advanced by Muslim groups, again, not to suggest that there's a conflict-free public sphere by doing so. I would think that any public sphere, by definition, involves negotiation, contestation, and conflict. But again, the point here is that by employing universalistic forms of claims making, they do actually participate in common public spheres, and they take part in the very processes of civil society. And this is something that we, as scholars, politicians, and administrators, commonly tend to overlook. Islamic organizations I study, they do not justify their demands by simply reaching back to religious teachings or traditions, but through a language of rights, thus citizenship. By using the rights language, they exercise civic projects and they link themselves to broader public spheres. The projects of citizenship in which they engage, they're not necessarily nationally bounded. When Islamic associations make demands about veiling in schools, there is not a claim for belonging to an existing French collectivity. What they're claiming for is inclusion of themselves within the very educational system, which they see as their most natural right. So the claim is not to belong to the existing French national collectivity, but to be part of the French educational system, which are two different things. And this, I argue, is not necessarily this engagement from collective life, but in this case, the collective is no longer defined by a preordained national community, in the sense that they actually try to redefine the very nature of this national community. Okay, so this is the first feature of the emerging modes of claims making. Again, in the sense that particularistic claims are connected to the universalistic discourse and agenda of individual rights. I would like to turn to the second feature now, very, very briefly. And that is the organizational strategies employed by collective groups increasingly acquire a transnational and subnational character. So their participation extends beyond the limits of national political arenas. They cover multiple localities and transnational connect public spheres. So in the case of immigrant groups, for example, we find political parties, mosque organizations, and community associations which operate at local levels, but also assume transnational forms. And they develop organizational connections between places of origin and destination. They carry back and forth institutional forms, bridging a diverse set of public spaces. For example, based on their experience in, and again, borrowing models from the German education system, some Muslim groups, to be more specific, Alawites, these are this is a subsect of Muslim community in Turkey, and they are organized both in Turkey and also in Germany. They have raised demands for the recognition of denominational schools in Turkey, and denominational schools currently do not have a legal standing in the Turkish educational system. But this kind of seeing their rights in Germany and bringing back those claims in Turkey, it's very, very common. In a similar vein, during the local elections in Berlin, Turkish immigrant groups pushed for their local voting rights, while at the same time put pressure on the Turkish government to facilitate their rights to vote in Turkish national elections. In that sense, they see their participation, they envision their participation both in Berlin and also in Turkey. Similar claims are being made by Mexican and Central American immigrant communities in the United States. They demand dual citizenship and dual voting rights in their countries of origin and residence. And indeed, the governments of Mexico, Colombia, and the Dominican Republic recently passed legislation allowing dual nationality. So all of this implies that the public spheres within which immigrants act, mobilize, and advance claims have broadened. In pursuing their claims, the mobilization of immigrant groups entails multiple states and multiple political agencies. They target trans and subnational institutions. As exemplified in the case of Islamic flourishry again, this was not a simple matter confined to the discretion of a local school board, although that's where it had started. But then it has traversed the realms of local, national, and transnational jurisdictions, again, from local educational authorities to the European Court of Human Rights. So while the claims and mobilization of Muslim groups aim to further particularistic identities and solidarities, paradoxically, they make appeals to the universalistic principles of human rights and connect themselves to a diverse set of public spheres. As such, their mobilization is not simply a reinvention of ethnic or religious particularisms. Drawing upon universalistic repertoires of human rights, they at the same time participate in and reaffirm host society and global discourses. As I try to show with my examples, the emerging forms of collective participation and claims making in Europe are less and less nationally defined citizenship projects. They are citizenship projects for sure, but they are not nationally defined. Individuals and collective groups set their agenda for realization of rights through particularistic identities, but these are particularistic identities which are embedded in and driven by universalistic and homogenizing discourses of human rights. And this shift in focus from national collectivity to particularistic claims does not necessarily implicate disengagement from participating in common public spheres. Neither does it mean the creation of disintegrated civic arenas. On the contrary, they are evidence for the emergent participatory forms and also multiple arenas and levels that individuals enact and practice their citizenship. As we approach the turn of another century, citizenship has come to fore as a trying issue, both theoretically and politically, in European polities. Our theories and policy prescriptions, however, have yet to respond to the changes in the institution of citizenship and respond to the challenge posed by the emergent actors, border crossings, and non-conventional mobilizations. To capture the current dynamics of citizenship, we need to move beyond traditional and revisit our theoretical vistas and normative frameworks. In concluding, I would like to suggest three correctives to our dominant conceptions of citizenship. First, the much taken for granted dichotomy of particular versus universal no longer holds. We have to consider the mechanisms by which the universalistic rights discourse not only reinforces particularistic identities and claims, but also concurrently normalize these very same identities. The particularistic identities and claims we encounter today are inevitable outcomes of the very universalistic principles to which we firmly adhere. Thus, the question here is not a matter of positive or negative recognition or even accommodation of these claims and identities. It seems that much of our debates really focus on this question. I would like to suggest that what really matters is the very process of negotiation, contestation, and dialogue in which these claims and identities are mobilized. Within this process, actors mutually change their self-understandings, revise their strategic action, and their demands. That's why our rules of engagement should be open to both confrontation and dialogue. After all, confrontation and dialogue are what constitute the basis of democratic public spheres. Second point, there are no longer absolute and clear-cut patterns of exclusions and inclusions. Neither do these patterns simply coincide with the bounds of the national. Access to a formal nationality status is not the main indicator for inclusion or exclusion in today's Europe. Rights, membership, and participation are increasingly matters beyond the vocabulary of national citizenship. Thus, on the one hand, we have to identify contexts and processes which are beyond the nation state and lead to simultaneous inclusions and exclusions. On the other hand, we need to bring back into our political agenda one of the main premises of sociology, that inclusion and exclusion are also issues of distribution. Not that this is a novel idea, but it does require a strong political will to do so. Thus, I think that it's worth repeating. And lastly, we can no longer frame our debates on membership and identities within the dichotomy of national and transnational, and also within the expected linear transition from one to the other. I think there is much confusion around this issue. We spend much time and energy in arguing whether we are approaching a transnational stage or whether we are not even getting there, whether we are still at a national stage. But I think that rather than treating national and transnational as stages in progress, we need to incorporate them into our theoretical frameworks as variables. These are variables that shape contemporary exclusions and inclusions, again, simultaneously. So in that sense, we have to take them as concurrent levels, not something that they oppose each other, but concurrent levels within which the current practices of citizenship and participation should be understood. And I will just stop there. Yeah.
Now, Dr. Soysel has kindly agreed to answer questions, and I think there's someone downstairs and upstairs, each with a radio microphone. So if you'd like to indicate if you wish to answer a question, and the mic will be brought to you. Any questions? Yes, one over there.
It's not clear to me precisely what inferences you are drawing from the increasing practice by more governments of the recognition of the accordance and the recognition of dual citizenship.
The major point that I was trying to make about dual citizenship is that it broadens the public spheres within which individuals and groups can act, because that means that they can access different rights in different political communities, and inevitably they would be connecting these two different political spheres. And that was the example that I was trying to give, mentioning the case of Berlin and Turkey. Again, in this case, obviously Turkish immigrants see their belonging and their mobilization, both in Turkey and also in Germany. And they don't see any paradox in this themselves. That was the implication that I was trying to relay. But I would assume that it's something that you don't agree, or?
Yes, down here.
Can I just go further with that one, really? It wasn't particularly my question, but as you've just stated and said before, the actual immigrant communities find no problems or paradoxes with the dual citizenship angle and different rights here and there. But that, of course, begs the question about the rest of the populations. Say, let's take the Turkish people in Germany. If they say can vote in Turkish elections too, you didn't say they could, but you did say that maybe Mexicans can now vote back in Mexico too, Surely then there's going to seem some discrepancy to those Turks who are still in Turkey. They are going to have different ideas and different expectations and so on and so forth. They might do, and they're certainly going to have more money. And likewise for the people in Germany who only have the one German citizenship, there's going to be a great deal of friction outside of the immigrant communities, I would think, and perhaps, you know, that's something that you need to mention at least.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you want an equality, then we should give everyone several citizenships so that they can vote wherever they live and wherever they have some kind of political interest and also investment. I think that the whole idea that Turkish immigrants living in Germany still have some kind of attachment to what's going on in Turkey, this is just a simple fact of our lives right now. I mean, these people do follow all the political developments in Turkey very easily because they are exposed to the Turkish television. They are being exposed to any kind of political development going on in Turkey. And that's the whole point about living in this kind of world where we can see and know about what's going in other places. And I don't see exactly, I mean, this is exactly like the argument that if with the European Union and advancement of the European Union, if other countries won't provide the same kind of welfare provisions that the Swedish state does, then we should take back everything and make them equal at the very minimal level. Why go for the minimal level and instead give everyone a right to participate in wherever they have connections to? I don't think that people have much interest. If they didn't have much investment and connection to Turkey, they wouldn't do it.
You haven't addressed the other people, though. I know, I understand.
Yeah, well, Germans do have a right to vote in other European countries in local elections, and maybe they should have also a right to vote in, I mean, they do have a right to vote in European Union issues as well, for the European Parliament. But that, I'm sorry.
Say
which other people.
Sorry. Say there are lots of Turkish people in Germany who are quite well off because they're earning German salaries as opposed to their friends and family back mm-hmm. in Turkish villages. Now, they might vote, and say there's a party in Turkey asking for, well, say the one that wants an Islamist country. Now, in theory, now this happens not just with the Turks, but with everybody. In theory, to them, sitting in Germany where it isn't actually going to affect them, they might well vote for it. But those people back home who've got to put up with it, or something like, I don't know, some economic thing, which is fine for them because it suits them, big companies or whatever, and they're working for them and they're not there, are they? But for the people who are actually there in Turkey, they might want and need something quite different, is all I'm just trying to point out.
But I don't think that, this necessarily...
Pass it forward.
I'm sorry, I don't think that this necessarily really contradicts the whole idea of dual citizenship. I mean, you can always make a case that for anyone to vote in two different political communities, they have to have some kind of residency requirement. That maybe that these people should live 6 months of their life in Turkey and then 6 months of their life in Germany so that they will have a right to do, or that they will have some kind of investment in Turkey. But it's not something that we can really control or introduce as a regulation. But it doesn't mean that we should be against dual citizenship.
After Bra.
I just want to say, first of all, that I enjoyed your talk very much. But my question really is to do with, perhaps I misunderstood you, but when you were giving the example of this Women's Day, you know, mm-hmm. and kind of certain claims to universalism, you please correct me if I got you wrong, but in one sense, I was a bit surprised that you didn't problematize the whole notion of universalism. What kind of, I mean, whose view of universal rights are we talking about here? Because when you talk about particularism and universalism, it seems to me that sometimes really you're talking about a European notion of universal as if it weren't a particular notion. In fact, if you look at sort of, you know, a whole lot of scholarship, we could in fact argue that the European liberal notion of universalism is actually a very particular notion. So that whether one agrees or not with that mullah's mm-hmm. claims, mm-hmm. That's a different matter. But nonetheless, mm-hmm. you know, one could actually see that mm-hmm. that it's a particular discourse of universalism, and in one sense, it theoretically at least, as legitimate as another, except that because of power relations and historical, you know, relations of colonialism, etc., it's not the case. Mm-hmm. It's just that I wondered.
Yeah,
that's all.
Yeah. No, it's very clear that this very notion is very much the liberal notion of universal rights, which particular in the sense that it originated from the Western world, but I think that it has become quite dominant in other parts of the world as well. It has a very, very hegemonic existence, I think, in other parts of the world as well. So in that sense, it might be particularistic in terms of where it originated, but in terms of its influence and its usage by other parts of by other cultures in other parts of the world, I think it's quite dominant now. Idea of a different idea of universal rights.
That,
yeah, I mean,
Yeah, that's very obvious. I mean, when the Chinese talk about human rights, they talk about a different kind of human rights. And in other parts of the world, they also talk about different kind of human rights. But that doesn't mean, especially for the groups that I'm talking about, I think that whole notion of human rights or personal rights that belong to the person, that's a very, very general understanding. It's not necessarily redefining that whole idea within the Islamic or any other kind of cultural understanding. But whether that would apply to their own communities or whether they would think that it should apply to their own communities, I think within the process, yes, there are many, many groups within which women, for example, Muslim women, do use these kind of discourses against their own dominant male partners or the male population of that group. I mean, they do make a case, Islamic women as well, that it's their individual right to reject some of the imposition of this religious teaching on them. So I think the ones that, again, you know, I would like to maybe confine this argument to the groups that I've been studying, which is, again, groups who live and experience the Western notions of liberal democracy, not necessarily the other parts of, and I do think that, you know, these notions do conflict at some points, and that's part of a whole power struggle and also power structure.
The gentleman in green who's been waiting for some time. Let them.
Yes. I too like to say that has been a fascinating lecture. But one of the things you seem to be saying is that you seem to be inverting the notion of radical democracy, which Lacow and
the notion of
radical democracy, because what they kind of assert is that from the particular they expand and contest and change the boundaries of the universal. You're kind of inverting it and saying actually that the very presence of the universal gives rise to the particular, which I find very fascinating. Sorry, it's more of a statement. I don't know if you can expand on it anymore.
Except that I very much agree with what you're saying. But it's, again, you know, I can make that point because I think that I find this point extremely important, that it's exactly the same, these universalistic principles that we have and we adhere to do justify these particularistic claims. So that's the, or particularistic identities, and I think that that's quite important to realize. If we want to have any kind of policy implication, but also in terms of our scholarly analyses, you know, otherwise it's very hard to understand, I think, what's going on right now.
How would women?
I too greatly appreciated your talk, and I found it very provocative. It seems to me that your overall position is that a certain kind of multicultural progress is underway, a rather unproblematic progress in many respects, an accommodation of difference that's taking place sort of within the overall differentialist problematic, if I might say that. Certainly giving rise to some kinds of conflicts, but nothing too upsetting, nothing too disruptive, nothing too explosive. And I want to ask you within that framework to address the problem of equality, since difference generally is framed in some relation to equality. And then within that, of course, the dynamic of racism as a central issue that seems to me must be brought to the fore by the kind of tendencies that you're discussing here, and that at some point would presumably threaten to derail the more utopian aspects of this universalistic drive that you seem to be suggesting is happening.
Okay. Well, I'm not quite sure if it's utopian in the sense that I do think that these claims do happen. I didn't talk about the accommodation of these claims, obviously. And there's two reasons for that. Because that, first of all, that would take a whole different lecture, another hour of lecturing. But secondly, as I said, I really think that the process itself is extremely important. The process of making claims is extremely important, through which, again, the nature of these claims and understanding of self-understandings of groups do change. If there's any kind of accommodation right now, I think that has a lot to do with these kind of interactions. I may sound like taking Habermasian view on discursive interactions as something real, but I do have problems with it as well, that I don't think that discursive processes necessarily lead to rational outcomes or some kind of coherent, harmonious societies. Not necessarily. I think that we will have conflicts. But this is an issue of give and take. So within this process, I think both the host societies and immigrant groups living in host societies do change their perspective. I mean, there has been quite a bit of accommodation of these claims, but that it's as a result of struggles, as a result of negotiations. So we really have to take the struggle part very, very seriously. But also, in terms of accommodation of these more explosive claims, or not accommodation of these explosive claims, I mean, we have to see that there are several different principles dominant in Western societies. Gender equality is an important, very important principle of Western societies. And I think women's groups have been very, very influential and very, very strong in the, again, in the last, since the post-war period, in making gender equality an important principle of Western societies, which means that a claim like female circumcision or polygamy, these will obviously contradict with another principle in Western society. I mean, if we think that groups would make these claims on the basis of religious equality, but they will face another issue of gender equality. And within this, the accommodation will depend on, again, the contradictory principles that exist in European societies, and also the hierarchy of these principles. I do think that women's gender equality has a very high priority in Western societies. So anything that would challenge that, I don't think will be accommodated. And
race,
I think that I will leave that to other experts in the room to talk about the issue of race. I mean, race in the sense that whether these claims are not accommodated because of the institutional racism, is that what you want to address? Or I'm not quite sure what to...
Persistent racial inequality between
okay.
the various groups that you're talking about and the quote-unquote native...
Okay, but when you say racial inequality, I assume that this is, we are talking about socioeconomic inequalities. I hope so. Yes, I mean, this is something that I wish that we talk more about. But I had to address the issues of identities and why they are so prevalent and dominant in our own discourses before I could talk about the issue of race and why we still have socioeconomic inequalities. That's why I was trying to really address at the very end when I talked, when I made the point that inclusion and exclusion is not only an issue of national belonging or in the sense that formal nationality. What we have to really talk about why there's still any all kind of socioeconomic inequalities. And I'm not quite sure it's only the issue of race. I think that it's a lot to do with the issue of class as well. The fact that I'm from Turkey and I never had any discrimination or anything that would make me feel different in Germany has a lot to do with the fact that I also did my PhD at Stanford in the United States, and that I had come from a educated background as opposed to guest workers who live there without having the same kind of educational level. It's not only an issue of race. It's a lot to do with the fact that we are talking about different classes of immigrants and different kind of socioeconomic backgrounds that we have.
I'm going to take two more questions. Lady in green, I think, towards that side. On the hand up.
Thank you. I'm probably sort of rather oversimplifying what you were saying, but the impression was somewhat cozy, with universalism and particularism moving comfortably hand in hand and with discourses and disputes in the public sphere. But if we actually look around us in Europe, you know, what we see are conflicting particularities. You know, what we see are sort of massacres and bloodbath and a complete abandonment of universalistic principles immediately on the ground. I mean, attempts to apply to courts of crimes in ex-Yugoslavia to courts of human rights, maybe an attempt to reassert universalistic values. But I just wondered if you could say something actually about the practical politics that we see in front of ourselves, which don't in any way accommodate this comfortable dialogue between these two levels.
I didn't mean that there is a comfortable dialogue at all. I think that the comfortable dialogue is within the immigrant communities themselves, who use universalistic discourses to make claims for particularistic claims. There's nothing easy about this whole process, and that's what I was trying to say, actually, that these universalistic principles do justify a case like Kosovo, for example. We are thinking that there is a Kosovo case with some kind of particularistic culture, and there is a human rights principle. We have to go and help Kosovo people. By doing so, actually, we are strengthening the whole idea of national cultures. And this is a particularistic identity. This is also a particularistic identity which is clashing with the Serbian identity. But that very human rights principle that's motivating right now NATO and the Western European countries is actually creating that particularism of national self-determination of, we call them Kosovan, of course, but they are only a part of the Kosovan population. Obviously, there were a small proportion, but still Serbian population living in Kosovo. But now we think that there is a Kosovan, there should be even a Kosovan nation state or some kind of determination, self-determination of people living in Kosovo. But that's actually, again, using the human rights principle, we are thinking that there is this kind of particularism that we need to support.
Actually, two more. Gentleman there and then lady here, where the mic is.
Hello. I wonder if you'd comment on the whole concept of European citizenship and European identity. Do you think that that's something that's slowly displacing the former national identities, and if so, is it a good thing?
No. That's, again, the last point that I was trying to make, that no, I don't see these as something replacing each other, you know, national and transnational, national and European. Everything that I see is actually the transnational is strengthening the national. That's the point that I'm trying to make. The European citizenship itself, at one point, on the one hand, it's undermining that kind of national citizenship by creating, again, a multi-tiered, you know, polity, and also the diffusion of sovereignty, but at the same time very much strengthening the state, the European state. I don't think that these are, they are contradictory as outcomes, but they are not contradictory given the way that we emphasize both human rights, transnational principles of all sorts, but also national sovereignty. These are two very important principles that are embedded in European Union, its treaties, it's actually the basis of the European Union, that national sovereignties are important, human rights are also important, but these are two contradictory principles that exist at the same time within our institutional frameworks in Western Europe. And that's the kind of, that those contradictory principles do provide us with contradictory outcomes. So I don't see them replacing or doing anything. If anything, they are actually reinforcing each other.
Lady in the front row, and then we'll draw to a close.
I was very interested in what you had to say about the way Muslim organizations are presenting their claims using a universal framework for particularistic requests. And you mentioned also that there had been considerable unification of Muslim organizations within Europe to do so. This certainly comes in your writings. I think you said it also today. What I wanted to ask you was, do you see this unification of Muslim organizations and the presentation of demands in universalistic discourse purely as an opportunistic thing, meeting the needs of European society, or if you like, responding to European organizations, perhaps the European Union, the framework within which mm-hmm. it's best possible mm-hmm. to operate? Mm-hmm. Or do you see some kind of internal motivation as well, whereby Muslim organizations feel that there is more in common within their different groups, churches, mosques, organizations throughout Europe, which, or perhaps of the ideas of different Muslim groups which come together, which also push forward this growing unification which you've outlined, or perhaps it isn't growing, this unification which you've outlined?
Okay, they probably collaborate with churches more than other mosques, actually. I don't think that, I'm sorry if I left that impression, but I don't think that there's any unification of Muslim groups per se. If anything, actually, Muslim communities are extremely divided in terms of their national backgrounds. I don't think that there is any, even a communication between, let's say, Muslims from Morocco and Muslims from Turkey in France. That's not what I really was trying to say. There are other kinds of unification, like Muslim organizations from Turkey, and even this are within certain sects, that they do organize at European level as well. They do that, but it's very much divided by national lines. So I wouldn't say that there is a unification of Muslim communities in Europe. That would be wrong, I think. In terms of strategic action or using these discourses as strategies, I think that every interest politics or every collective mobilization do have some strategic element. So do Muslim groups' mobilization. Anyone who mobilizes around claims, they have to have certain strategies. So I don't see them as different than any other group making claims in European countries. In that sense, I don't have a suspicion of what they are doing, in the sense that, yes, they do use these strategically, but so do gays and lesbians, women's groups, and everyone else. So I don't see that much of difference in the way that these discourses
are. No, nor do I. I just wondered whether you did.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I think I'd like to close the questions now. If you've still got questions, I'm sure there'll be a chance to ask Dr. Soysel informally. And I'd like to invite you to come upstairs to the reception in the senior common room, which is on the fifth floor, which you can reach by the two lifts in the foyer, or if you're very energetic, you can walk up the stairs. But before we close, I would like to thank Dr. Soysel very much, both for a very stimulating and theoretically acute lecture, and for responding to the questions, which clearly show that members of the audience have engaged with what she has to say. I'd also like to tell you that the lecture will be published in the journal in the January 2000 issue, so you will have an opportunity to return to it and actually read it in print. And there are indeed other articles that have appeared and will appear in the journal which relate to these issues. For example, we just published an issue in March on transnational communities, which is mainly about Latin American migrants to the United States, which has a slightly different orientation to the emphasis this evening. But we're very glad to be hosting an occasion like this, and we're extremely grateful to Dr. Soysel for
Thank
her
you very much.
Stimulating
Thank
efforts. Thank you.